You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everybody. Happy Bastille Day. My name is Jonathan Derbyshire. I'm managing editor of Prospect magazine. I'm delighted to welcome you all today. This is my enormous pleasure to introduce this afternoon's distinguished guest speaker. Sudhir Hazira Singh has been a fellow and tutor in politics at Balliol College, Oxford, since 1990. He's a fellow of the British Academy, and among his award-winning books are The Legend of Napoleon and Le Mythe Gaulien. He joins us today, though, to talk about his new book, How the French Think, which is a sweeping, spirited and highly entertaining exploration of the ideas of some of the most influential French thinkers of the past 400 years, an exploration, too, of the distinctive character of French culture and of the prominent role that intellectuals, like Sudhir himself, have played in French collective life, public life. Recently, though, some observers have expressed the view that this glorious intellectual and cultural history is exactly that, a historical relic, a thing of the past. And so the book appears at a time when, some argue, French thought has been, for a considerable amount of time now, in the doldrums, even in crisis. The Charlie Hebdo shootings in January this year exposed, so the argument goes, deep economic and social fractures in French society and heightened a growing anxiety about France's place in a globalised world order. Although recent events might lead us to want to discuss France's place in the world this afternoon. So in the book and in his talk today, Sudhir examines what may have caused the recent loss of confidence in French public life and asks how a once globally influential intellectual heritage might be revived. So let's get started, and please join me in welcoming Sudhir Hazira Singh.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, and thank you to all of you for coming to hear me speak this afternoon. And thank you to the RSA for this kind invitation, and thanks to Jonathan, too, for kindly agreeing to chair. I'd also like to take the opportunity, since I see him sitting here in the front row, to thank my editor at Allen Lane, Stephen Prophet, who really played an essential role in encouraging, shaping this project from the outset. It was a real pleasure working with him, so I'm glad to be able to take this opportunity to say so on the record. So, ladies and gentlemen, how do the French think? My basic argument in the book is that it's really a product of historical factors, and I'd like to say something very briefly about what those historical factors are. So I'll start by just sketching some of the main features of French thought, talk about these kind of historical and cultural factors that have shaped it, then say something about the strength of French thinking, of the French way of thinking, because French thought has brought us some wonderful things, and I'd like to just spend a few minutes kind of outlining them for you, and then spend another few minutes talking about the downside, the weakness, the problems associated with French thought. So strengths and weaknesses I will deal with a little bit, and then come to the subject that Jonathan flagged in his very kind introduction, which is the current French malaise, this kind of gloomy zeitgeist that we see emanating from Paris, and I'll try and say something about what it is, why the French are now in this rather negative state, and whether there might still be reasons for us Francophiles to hope, especially on this auspicious day for France. So what do I mean when I talk about French thought? What are the kind of key features of French thinking? First of all, I think the French are very committed to rationalism, to the idea that reason is the defining feature of humankind. And this goes all the way back to René Descartes, the great philosopher, who famously said, "I think, therefore I am, cogito ergo sum." And that really is the launching pad for this great kind of rationalist tradition that you see developing all the way through up to the late 20th century. And what's interesting about that tradition is that a wide variety of thinkers, whether they're on the left or on the right, associate themselves explicitly with Descartes. So Descartes really is the founding father of a rationalist tradition, which I think remains very much alive, even up to the present. Even those who kind of oppose Descartes do so explicitly on the basis of what he himself argues. So I think there's this kind of Cartesian rationalism, which is very much part of the French tradition. What else is there? There's the love of general notions. You don't have to dig very deep into French thinking to find reference to abstractions, reference to overarching frameworks. You know, the French love isms, so the French have given us republicanism, positivism, socialism, existentialism, structuralism. You know, one could rattle off a kind of long list of isms, and that's one of the kind of characteristics of modern French thought, that it has produced and generated all these different isms. And beyond these kind of isms, what there is a particular method of thought, which philosophers call the deductive method. And that's simply stated, it's the idea that you start with a kind of general proposition and eventually work your way to a specific conclusion. The Brits typically do it the other way around. They start with something specific, with induction, and then work their way through to a general conclusion. So there's a kind of contrast there, which has very often been made. But it's one of the kind of characteristic differences between the French and the English, and maybe we can talk about that in the questions. Thirdly, there's also what you might call a rebellious, contrarian, a kind of disputatious quality to French thought. Montaigne, I think, said something like, there's no conversation more boring than the one in which everybody agrees. And he's capturing something that is, again, quintessentially French. You see it across the ages. I sometimes tease my French friends, and I say, even when you're agreeing with me, it sounds as though you're kind of shouting at me. And sometimes one has that slight feeling in France that people argue for the sake of arguing. But this notion of disputatiousness is very much present in the French tradition. And that is reflected also in the kind of dualistic quality of French thought, the kind of love of dividing things into two, good and evil, progress and decadence. It sometimes seems when you're observing a French discussion that everything has to be boiled down into two opposing camps. And it's no accident that the French have invented the division between the left and the right. You know, this is one of the kind of classic ways in which we measure political space. And this comes right out of the French Revolution. The French kind of invented this idea that people who are progressive are called people on the left, and people who are conservative are called people on the right. It was a historical accident, by the way. You know, it happened simply because a group of parliamentarians who were progressive went and sat on one side of the assembly, and people with the conservative views went and sat on the right-hand side. Who knows what would have happened if they'd done it the other way around. Anyway, dualism, that's also a kind of characteristic feature. And last but not least, there is what I would call universalism. There is this projection of French thought into the world. The French, classically, from the late Middle Ages onwards, have thought of themselves as a people who don't just think for themselves, but think for the world. And you find examples of this across all different, across a very wide range of philosophies and traditions of thought. There's a kind of messianic quality to French thinking, and one of many possible quotes about this or reflecting this comes from the historian Ernest Lavisse, who's a kind of Republican historian who was writing in the late 19th and early 20th century, and Lavisse tells us, and I quote, "France is charged with representing the cause of humanity." So, universalism. So, this is a kind of very boiled-down version of the kind of essential features of French thinking. Now, what I want to go on to say very quickly is that I don't believe in national character or I don't believe that these are somehow kind of inherent or essential features of French thought. I'm not making a kind of anthropological argument saying that this is how the French have been ever since they were Gaulois, and this is how they will always be. Because I don't really believe one can talk about national character in intellectual terms. Because these characteristics that I have described, I think the way we should think about them is to think about them as social and cultural constructs. They are things that have developed over quite a long period of time. And my argument in the book is that they have developed over about four centuries, really, from the mid 16th century onwards, from Descartes onwards, really. And they have taken the form that we now associate with them over this long period of time. And what that also means is that French thought has a particular historical character, and that historical events, historical factors, have played a very important role in shaping it. And I want to just underline one or two of these historical factors that have been very important in shaping how the French think. I think the legacy of the Enlightenment is very significant, particularly the late Enlightenment or the High Enlightenment, as it's sometimes called. Basically, the mid to late 18th century, the philosophes, people like Voltaire, Rousseau, Diderot, these people are the ones who, in a sense, defined French thought in the sort of way I've just outlined. This kind of emphasis on rationalism, the attachment to these overarching frameworks, the kind of rebelliousness. You find all of that in the writings of the philosophe. And then, of course, there's the French Revolution, 1789, the anniversary of which we're celebrating today. And the revolution really shapes the way the French think about themselves in absolutely fundamental ways. It gives us what I call a political culture of generality. So everything about how the French think about themselves is defined in general, abstract terms. So with the revolution, you have the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the citizen. So that's an idea of citizenship which is framed around general principles. A little bit later, you have liberty, equality, fraternity. That's another example, again, of how the French think about themselves through these abstract and general terms. And you have, through the revolution, this idea, this very French idea of a nation, which is an idea of a nation not based on ethnicity or blood, but an idea of a nation based on shared principles and shared values. And that's something that comes straight out of the revolution and continues to shape the way the French think about their collective identity up to today. So the Enlightenment, the revolution, the Republic, the Republican tradition. There's also, I think, historically, this idea that emerges over time. I don't think it's very recent, although its most spectacular manifestations have been since the Second World War. But there's also over time this notion of the French the French see themselves as a nation of resistors, as a nation whose vocation it is to resist tyranny. I mean, this is part of the story that comes out of the revolution, of course, the idea that the revolution was necessary because of the the tyranny of the absolutist regime. But when you look at the way the French talk about themselves in the 19th century or in the First World War, this idea of the French as a hardy, sturdy nation of resistors is already there, implicitly. And of course, it comes out during the Second World War with General de Gaulle, with the whole discourse about the resistance. And it's then popularized in the 50s and 60s in the comic strip Adventures of Asterix. You know, Asterix is the Gaulois, and who are the Gaulois? They are the sort of irreducibly French villagers who resist the occupation of the Romans and are feisty, querulous. But ultimately, they embody this kind of civic idea of the revolutionary and the republican tradition. So this idea of the French as a nation of resistors, I think, is something that we should also bear in mind, something that emerges historically but is reinforced by the experience of the Second World War, and it's very much part of how the French see themselves today. If you ask the French, you know, do you see yourselves as a nation of resistors at the moment, the overwhelming answer is yes. They resist, or they see themselves as attempting to resist globalization. They see themselves as wanting to resist the influence of the dastardly Anglo-Saxons. They see themselves as trying to resist the imposition of French, of English language and American culture. So this notion of resistance plays a very important role, I think, in the French self-image. Last but not least, in the why and how this French self-image has emerged, I think institutions are really important. And this underlines the point I'm making, that this isn't just some kind of essential characteristics of the French as a people. It's been produced by political and cultural institutions. And really, from the Revolution onwards, the French state, the French public authorities go about forging a certain idea of what it means to be French through the education system, through elite institutions like the École Normale. One of the small but significant ways in which this kind of notion of ideas mattering continues to play a role in French public life is simply the place of philosophy in the secondary school curriculum. You know, everybody doing the BAC has to take philosophy. No matter what you're specializing in, you have to take philosophy in France. And that, of course, is very different from what happens in this country. So that's my second point. The French way of thought has certain general characteristics, but these general characteristics have evolved over time and have been constructed socially and politically. So what are the advantages and disadvantages of a way of thought like this? Well, I think the strengths are almost self-evident to anyone who surveys French intellectual production over the past three centuries. The French have been extraordinarily creative and inventive. It seems to me if we think, I mean, I'm a political scientist, and so my examples tend to be drawn particularly from that part of the sort of intellectual firmament. But if you just look at the words that we use in political science, words like ideology, words like popular sovereignty, even the discipline of sociology, these are terms that are invented by French thinkers. The notion of the public intellectual is one that has become universal, of course, and most countries, all countries that are pluralistic and where the free debate of ideas is allowed, most countries have public intellectuals. But the French public intellectual is something very distinct, and the notion of the intellectual as someone with a distinct moral and spiritual mission, that too is a French invention. It comes out in the late 19th century during the Dreyfus Affair, and ever since then, French intellectuals have continued to play a very important role in French public life. What they're doing at the moment is perhaps something that we might want to discuss. But so there's this creativity and inventiveness, which is very important. There's also this magnificent boldness that you have in French writing and in French thinking. The French like to see things in grand schemes. They have grand objectives. If you look at the utopian tradition, which is very rich in France, that's something that you find which manifests itself throughout the 18th, 19th, all the way up to the mid to late 20th century. The other thing that is very striking about French kind of boldness is the aspiration of different schools of thought to provide what I would call total explanations. I mean, in Britain, most philosophers or social theorists would say you can't provide a total explanation for anything, right? The tendency here is to say, you know, we need to be modest, we need to be prudent, we need to not overreach ourselves. But the great kind of philosophical and historical schools of the 20th century have tried or have seen themselves as providing total explanations. The most famous historical school produced, which comes out of France in the 20th century, is called the Annales. And they saw themselves as doing total history. That's how they called it. If you read Sartre's Critique of Dialectical Reason, he says, you know, my objective in writing this treatise is to find out whether there is such a thing as truth in humankind. Truth in humankind, right? So this is boldness, right? This is really boldness at its very best. What you also get, of course, in France, and it's almost it's so obvious that I don't think I even need to spend much time on it, is you get a tradition of contestation. You get a tradition of challenging established views. You get a tradition of radical and dissenting views. And this is something you find from the High Enlightenment all the way through to people like Fanon, people like Foucault, people like Sartre. So I regard this as positive because, again, it comes out of this kind of skeptical tradition which Descartes initiated, which is that, you know, you should not take propositions as self-evident. You should treat them with skepticism, and you should only eventually agree with them until you have subjected them to close rational scrutiny. And out of that, you get this, what I regard as this wonderful dissenting tradition. Now, these are some of the strengths. Things sometimes don't go entirely well with the French tradition of thought, so there are some weaknesses as well that I highlight in the book. I think universalism can be problematic because universalism at its best projects France into the world in a kind of very benevolent way. So you have the idea of fraternity, for example, which is a very positive example of universalism. But at its worst, universalism can simply be an incapacity of the French to see the others except as a mirror of themselves. So sometimes when the French see another people, they see themselves in that other people. The French Gaullist writer André Malraux, when he went to visit Mao Zedong in the 1960s, told Mao that the Chinese were the French of Asia, les Français d'Asie. Not sure how well it went down. But that's a kind of example of how universalism can sometimes end up as a kind of projection of the French into the world. Deductive reasoning, I think, can be problematic too because it can lead to excessive abstraction and a sort of disconnection from reality. And I'll illustrate this a little bit later when I talk about the French approach to multiculturalism because it does seem to me that one of the problems with the way the French think about multiculturalism is a product of their over-reliance on abstraction and on the deductive method of reasoning. And then there's skepticism, which is a good thing when used in moderation, but if you keep subjecting everything to skepticism, I think that can be ultimately both philosophically and practically unproductive. Philosophically, because you eventually undermine the very basis, the very epistemological basis of knowledge, and it seems to me that that's what the postmodernists and the deconstructionists have done. They've kind of worn everything down in terms of sort of logical foundations of what we can say, so that now we can't really say anything, because anything that we say is subject to undermining and deconstruction. So I think skepticism of a particular kind, this kind of extra ultra skepticism can be problematic. And politically, of course, the French, nobody does anarchy and chaos as well as the French. They have a kind of fantastic tradition in that respect. And it was this that de Gaulle had in mind, obviously, when he famously said, how can you govern a country that produces 246 varieties of cheese? You know, we are just too individualistic. And that's kind of, it's that sense of frustration that he was expressing there. So that brings me to the current malaise. Now, the French This is a difficult year historically, in terms of historical anniversaries. It's the anniversary of the Battle of Waterloo, which was barely mentioned, of course, in France. I think it was slightly overdone in this country, to be perfectly honest with you. But I would have hoped for a kind of happy compromise between not saying anything at all and this rather strange series of ceremonies that we had here. But anyway, let's leave that aside. The more general point, and this is what I argue in the book, is that French thought has been in the doldrums really since the late 20th century. And there are a variety of factors that kind of contributed to this. There was the last kind of heroic generation of great intellectuals who all died more or less at the same time, from Raymond Aron to Michel Foucault to Althusser to Roland Barthes. Everybody more or less kind of, Sartre, more or less disappeared within a kind of 4 or 5 year period. Gaullism and communism, which were the two big kind of political traditions that dominated post-war politics, imploded more or less at the same time in the late 20th century. The French have become increasingly worried about what they call their social model, you know, which is a particular form of an interventionist welfare state that spends a lot on health, on education, spends a lot on public infrastructure. They're worried now whether they'll be able to sustain this, whether this kind of pattern of having this social model is going to be viable. And then there's also been the rise of what I call increasingly kind of nostalgic, backward-looking visions. And this is all this discussion that you have about collective memory that develops in France from the late 20th century onwards and that is associated with the works of Pierre Noir, the lieu de mémoire. It seems that the French are now, French historians, spend much more time kind of celebrating the Third Republic, celebrating the kind of golden age of French history. So they seem to be more turned towards the past than looking forward into the 21st century. So there's this kind of obsession with memory and with identity. And then last but not least, there is what you might call bleak chic, this kind of pessimistic discourse about death, about decay, which again has a very long tradition in France. But now it just seems to have become the dominant discourse in French intellectual circles. It's articulated by intellectuals like Alain Finkielkraut, who was elected to the Académie Française a couple of years ago, or last year, I think, and of course by novelists like Michel Houellebecq, who's the great kind of the most doomy writer you might imagine. I mean, Houellebecq has been saying now, at least in his last three novels, that France is finished. I mean, his novels are all, you know, variations on this theme. But the latest one, which is Soumission, sees the French kind of give up completely, right, and elect a moderate Islamist president who completely throws out the whole kind of Enlightenment heritage and turns France into this very conservative, order-seeking political community. So, you know, the title kind of says it all, soumission, submission. You know, the French have lost the will to live, according to Houellebecq. And he is their best novelist. I mean, I find his politics detestable, but he does write wonderfully. And it says something about where the French are at the moment, that this is the man who, in a sense, represents French literature to the outside world. So things are very gloomy. Time magazine, you know, every year produces its list of 100 most influential people. And there were only two French people in the 2015 list. One was Thomas Piketty, the economist, who's been writing very interesting things about world capital. The other was Marine Le Pen, the leader of the extreme right. And again, it seems to me to be saying something about the state of France today, that it's the leader of the extreme right who is regarded as the most influential, one of the most influential people. And this kind of parlous state of French thought is further reflected in, I promised I would say a word or two about this, and I will do so now, in the discussion of multiculturalism. Because this is a problem that all European societies face. I mean, we face it here. It's a very serious issue here, and it's an especially serious issue in the wake, as Jonathan pointed out in his introduction, in the wake of what happened, the Charlie Hebdo massacre in January 2015. So this has a kind of particular French angle, but it's also not a problem that the French have faced alone. However, it seems to me the French have approached this in a way that kind of highlights the pitfalls of some of their traditional patterns of thinking. Let me give you a couple of examples of this. One is that the French write about the status of their ethnic minorities or their post-colonial minorities, most of whom come from North Africa, without any kind of reference to empirical evidence. It's very striking that there are actually no reliable statistics about French ethnic minorities. And there's a reason for this. Namely that it's illegal to collect statistics about ethnic minorities. Because when I say to my French friends and colleagues, well, why don't you do this? They say, well, it's contrary to Republican tradition. In a secular republic, people are equal, and so there are no distinctions of race. But I then say, well, that doesn't stop you from legislating about these people and stopping them from doing certain things. And then the discussion gets heated, which is fine. Perhaps we can have some of it here. But it seems to me a basic principle of rational discussion is that the discussion should be based on facts, right? We don't know how many North African immigrants go to mosque, for example. We have no idea. We don't know whether they speak French at home. You read these kind of scaremongering articles, particularly in the conservative press in France, saying they don't speak French at home. They don't know this. They have no way of knowing this because there's no kind of solid sociological inquiry about this. So this is just to say there are no statistics about this, so the information is often based on fear and on rumor. There's something worse, which is that the discussion is framed around the whole question of laïcité. And I think that is a problem, too. Because laïcité was a principle arrived at during the Third Republic in the early 20th century. And it was explicitly not intended as a way of regulating the behavior of social groups. Laïcité is a negative principle. It says the state has nothing to do with religion. Religion belongs to the private sphere. And in the private sphere, people can do whatever they like, provided, of course, they don't break the law. And that was what laïcité was supposed to represent. Laïcité now, when it's discussed in the context of French Islam, is being used as a way of almost forcing the French Maghrebi communities, the French post-colonial communities, to adopt a lifestyle or a set of values which they may not particularly share. And that's contrary to the spirit of the 1905 law. It's also contrary to, because the implication there is that laïcité is an inherent part of being French. And my French friends often say this to me, but you don't understand, you know, you Brits, you don't have this. For us French, laïcité is an essential component of our identity. But then I say to them, but do you know that in Alsace, the law of 1905 has never been implemented? So do you regard your Alsatian compatriots as un-French? The discussions get heated again there. So there are issues here, right, which the French need to confront. They need to think about this in a properly systematic way, right? And they need to address it in a way, it seems to me, which takes facts into account rather than just rumor. So I've said enough about what's problematic. I'll just say in 1 minute where I think there might still be hope. One is France is always divided into two, and there is an optimistic France. It's essentially the younger people, the more educated people, the people who live in cities. They have a kind of buoyant, outward-looking approach, and I think that that's something that will grow over time. The French are still capable of producing stimulating applied theory. Piketty, I think, is a very good example of that. French sociology is actually in a rather productive phase at the moment. There's someone called Emmanuel Todd who does very interesting applied work as well, and he's bringing out a book which will be translated into English called Who is Charlie, which is coming out in September, which I think has some very interesting things to say about the whole French reaction to the whole Charlie thing. So there is creative work being done. And France still, and that's the note on which I will end, it remains an intellectual nation. It's a country where a great amount is still spent by the state on culture. The state subsidizes independent bookshops, for example. It still has a recognizable intellectual class. And it's still a country which, for good or ill, reasons conceptually. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sade, for that magisterial tour d'horizon of French thought since Descartes. It's a long story. Listening to what you were saying about the disputatious quality of French thought, I was reminded of arriving in Paris as a graduate student and being struck when I first turned up at the École des Hautes Études that the French word for lecture theatre is amphithéâtre, amphitheatre, which fits exactly with this notion of intellectual life as a form of combat. You identified some of the main features of French thought over the centuries, the love of general notions, the addiction to dualisms, and so on. There's one feature which you didn't mention in your talk, but which you do discuss in the book, and it's this idea of history as something which proceeds as a series of abrupt ruptures or breaks. There's a very interesting example of this notion, which I think is widely shared among the intellectual elite. Recently, Pierre Nora, who you mentioned, the historian, very sober fellow, one of the pillars of the most venerable publishing house in France, Gallimard, was describing the extraordinary demonstrations and mobilizations on the 11th of January in the immediate aftermath of the Charlie Hebdo massacre. And he said, this event marks, and I'm paraphrasing, but this event marks a rupture or a break in French history on the scale of May 68. That's very characteristically French, isn't it?
Yes, very characteristically French, and I think it was Claude Lévi-Strauss who said that all the great kind of speculative structures that we invent have a sort of shelf life of around 30 years. We, meaning the French, give it a shelf life of about 30 years, then we overturn it. And if you look at French intellectual history over the past, at least the past 200 years, that's kind of very characteristic. Mm. I mean, certainly if you look at it post-war, there's a kind of existentialist moment that then kind of collapses. Then you have the kind of structuralist moment, which lasts about 15, 20 years. That collapses. Marxism is kind of ticking along during this whole period, and it comes down as well. The thing that seems characteristic of the current moment, though, is there hasn't been the emergence, it seems to me, there hasn't been the emergence of a kind of alternative framework of the kind that of a similar nature to these previous kind of grand theories. So maybe we're just in a kind of interregnum. Mm.
One of the consistent features of French intellectual life since the revolution has been precisely an endless struggle over the meaning of the revolution.
Yes.
Since it's the 14th of July today, I'd like to ask you about the institution, the public holiday, the 14 juillet, because that was established, as I think I'm right in saying, during the Third Republic. And it was based on a very particular reinterpretation of the meaning of the revolution, wasn't it?
Yes, it's very interesting because in 1880, when the Third Republic is just being re-established, they have to decide how they're going to commemorate the revolution. And they don't want to commemorate it as a kind of radical event because they're very worried that they'll scare the middle classes and the peasantry. So they reinvent the revolution, really, not as an event that leads to the overthrow of the monarchy, but they reinvent it as a moment in which the French nation comes together. And the 14th of July that we celebrate and that the French celebrate is actually not the 14th of July 1789, which was the capture of the Bastille. It's the 14th of July 1790, which was the first anniversary of the revolution, when they had a big festival in the Champ de Mars, where pretty much everybody all the different factions came together. And so that's the kind of ideological reinvention that takes place. And of course, this unity was relatively fleeting, because then things went slightly pear-shaped with the revolution. But when the legislators of the Third Republic debated amongst each other which date to find, they chose the 14th of July because it has this ambiguous quality.
I want to bring the audience in a minute. Just one more question before I do that, about what you were talking about at the end, the tensions in the French model of laïcité and the assimilationist model of citizenship that it entails. There's a paradoxical quality to what you were saying, and as also, as another point you make in the book, that paradox is one of the French are addicted to paradox. On the one hand, you were saying one of the great strengths of the French model of notion of citizenship is that it's non-ethnic. It's based in ideas of liberty, fraternity, and equality. But you're also saying that's one of the problems, particularly when France is trying to deal with its North African Muslim population.
Yes, I think it. You're right that in principle, what the kind of French tradition has given us is an idea of citizenship that makes no reference to ethnicity or race. The danger, however, is that that idea is then used to stigmatize or to target minority groups which don't fit in with what are perceived as the dominant values of the Republic. And the Republican tradition has bad history in this respect, because at the time of the revolution, the exact same argument was used against the Bretons, for example. Mm-hmm. They were accused of being counter-revolutionary. But it wasn't just individuals from Brittany. It was the Bretons as a kind of group who were regarded as potentially treacherous. And it seems to me that once you start making that kind of argument, then you're no longer in Republican territory. And that's where the revolution, it seems to me, went very badly wrong. And they're making the same mistake again today, some people in the Republican camp, by saying that the Maghrebi communities, as a community, are not subscribing sufficiently to the Republican ideal. I don't think you can make that sort of argument.
I'm sure there are questions. Who has a question?
Thank you. I've got a few questions. I think that Descartes should have said, "I think, therefore I behave," not "I think, therefore I am," because there isn't a lot of consciousness in our behavior generally. And I see, it's only my opinion, and I get into trouble. I think that the French are very reactionary, because Voltaire and Rousseau, they didn't do what they preached. But my question to you is that are you saying that Fanon was a French intellectual because he was against France and he preached violence against the French? And also Sartre did question that concept of we are all responsible for our deeds, especially when he went to a German prison, and then he thought it's not possible to always totally be responsible.
I take your point about Descartes. On Fanon, what I try to do in the book is show what were the philosophical influences on him. And when you look at how his thought is shaped, it's shaped very, very classically by French Republican thinking and by Sartre. All his readings in the 40s and 50s are French readings. So, of course, he comes out with a very anti-French view over Algeria, but his thought has been shaped by what I would call the French radical Republican tradition. And when The Damned of the Earth is reviewed in the New York Review of Books, the title of the review is The Black Rousseau.
This question at the front.
My question is how the French literary conceptual tradition works with Popper. You know, Popper is all about refutation and substituting new patterns of thought for existing ones. On the other hand, Popper is also very cumulative. The knowledge enterprise is a cumulative one that never ceases, and it doesn't really seem compatible with the idea of periodic rupture. So the question is, how do those work?
The French have not really engaged very much with Popper and the Popperian tradition, and I think it's at least as much for political reasons as for methodological reasons, because Popper is very critical of the whole kind of enterprise that the French carry out in the Revolution, and so I think the French have been kind of skeptical of Popper's method, at least as much for that reason as for methodological reasons.
Thank you. A very interesting talk, no doubt. But I'm somewhat skeptical about your proposition that there is a fundamentally different way of the French think in a fundamentally different way. If it was so, it should also be reflected in the science and mathematics. Do you have any evidence of that fundamental difference in their thought in the area of mathematics and physics and science? Thank you.
Well, mathematical language is formal, and so there's a sense in which the French contribute to mathematical excellence over the past two centuries. I mean, great mathematicians are around in the 18th, 19th, 20th centuries. See, my argument is not that the French have a kind of distinctive way of thinking in all disciplines. It's that the French will give a kind of particular importance and a particular role to a mathematician if he excels in his discipline. And it is possible for a mathematician to become a public intellectual and then to tell us things that are not just about mathematics, but about how we should live our lives, where we should go on holiday. That is what is characteristic of the French traditions. It's that excellence in one discipline entitles you to tell you about the good life in all other areas. And that is what is striking about the French. Not that they have good or bad mathematicians. It seems to me there that their record is probably on par with most other nations.
There's a question there.
I don't understand this business of mysticism, which seems to find itself in the heart of the French tradition. Mitterrand's astrologer might be a small example of that. Can you help me to understand that a bit better?
Thank you, yes. Well, thank you for that question, because it was one of the things that that surprised me most when I did the research for this book. Because everybody knew that Mitterrand consulted an astrologer, but I thought this was just a kind of quirky aspect of him. But when I looked back, I saw that actually there is a long tradition in France, particularly in the progressive camp. This is a phenomenon that you see on the left. You see it among Republicans. And it combines a belief in science. I mean, going back to the previous question, it combines a belief in rationality and in science with a belief that there is an afterlife, with a belief that there are ghosts. Victor Hugo famously, you know, has these seances of table tapping when he's in Jersey in the early 1850s. So right from the High Enlightenment, all the way through to the late 20th century, there is what I describe as a kind of progressive mystical tradition. And it combines, this is what is kind of characteristic of it and slightly peculiar, it combines a resolute belief in science and in rationality with a belief in the afterlife. And I think what it is in a sense a belief in the complete empire of reason, right? Reason is so powerful that it can conquer everything. It can even conquer things that we don't necessarily see. That's the kind of thought, right? It's a kind of ultra-rationalism.
Question there, then one at the back.
My question is, do the French think too much? perhaps I'll just ramble on for a moment. I was involved in a two-day conference in Paris about whether the French should have a museum of the information age.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly as the UK delegate and the people from Belgium and other countries were very concerned about getting hold of the kit before it went on the scrap heap so that you could actually have an object to look at. For about most of the 2 days, we listened while the French people worried about, is there a philosophical reason for having
it? Well, I'm sure you all heard the story, but in Tocqueville's Souvenirs, he describes the visit of a French railway engineer who comes to see a railway line that's already been built in England. And the engineer comes from France, looks at the tracks, and says, this thing is impossible. It doesn't fit with the theory.
Or as someone is reputed has said, it's all very well in in practice, but doesn't work in theory.
What about the theory?
There's a question there.
How do you explain that in France, any major event is always blessed by either l'archevêque or le curé, whoever it may be? My experience of quite formal events in always there is a pontifical high mass or something getting very close to it for a country that is so now embedded in a republican and laissez-faire philosophy from top to bottom.
So it's a question about the place of Catholicism.
Yes, and I think it's a very important question. And I think the high water mark of anti-clericalism is the late 19th, early 20th century. And the turning point is the First World War. And after the First World War, silently, the French bring the church back in, and they bring it in a lot of different ways. If you look at war memorials, many of them after the First World War and after the Second World War, you'll find religious emblems on them. And de Gaulle was very keen under the Fifth Republic that the church shouldn't be excluded. The French sometimes make a distinction between a laïcité ouverte, an open laïcité, and a laïcité fermée, a closed laïcité. Laïcité ouverte is one that includes everybody, including those who believe. And I think the French, until the recent debate over multiculturalism, where I think they've slipped back into a closed version, they've become much more accommodating, certainly of the Catholic Church. And the reason for that is very simple. The Catholic Church no longer poses a threat to the Republic.
You mentioned Emmanuel Todd, and in fact, in his book, Le Mystère Français, it's an exploration actually of how what he calls zombie Catholicism lingers as a kind of potent political force in France, and was particularly active in the demonstrations against the law legalising gay marriage. So there's a question with the woman here and then the gentleman there.
After the French experience, dreadful experience of the Nazi occupation, how do you account for the increase in popularity of Marine Le Pen?
Oh, gosh, how much time do we have? I think the short answer is that her rise bears witness to the failure of the political class as a whole. It's because neither the right nor the left, neither the moderate right nor the moderate left, have been able to provide the French with the reassurance and with the kind of answers that they want on some of the kind of difficult problems, social and political problems that they face. Having said that, I have to admit also that she's a very effective politician. She's not like her father. She has a strategy which is to kind of mainstream the extreme right, not to kind of keep it out on the margin. And it's been a strategy that has been working so far. In the long run, her objective is to kind of cannibalize the former UMP, who are now called the Republicans, and turn create a kind of large right-wing bloc around her party. And if she continues to be as successful as she has been up to now, it's very possible that she will succeed.
We'll take one last question because we are running out of time just here.
Yeah. Speaking of one of the defining traits of the French being résistance, how was that concept applied to its colonial territories or peoples, in its sort of colonies, for instance?
Yes, no, that's a very good question, because I think there's a contradiction there, because the French thought of them, they always used the kind of rhetoric of republicanism when they talked about their colonial empire, but of course in practice, the French didn't apply those great principles of liberty, equality, and particularly fraternity. I'm very struck by the time Algeria became independent in 1962, that 95% of the native population, of the non-European population in Algeria, still couldn't read or write. So that's a terrible, damning kind of verdict on 130 years of colonial rule. But the idea of resisting, I think, applies mainly to how France sees its place in the world. Because if you look at Gaullism, Gaullism is at its best when it's saying no, right? It's saying no to Germany, it's saying no to the Europeans, it's saying no to the British twice, and then it's saying no to the Americans. De Gaulle really loved saying no. You know, it was kind of, he was really in his element in that respect.
I'm afraid we have run out of time. I should say that copies of How the French Think are on sale in the auditorium. If you haven't already bought one, I can't believe that you haven't already bought one. Sudhi will be happy to sign copies for you. Rather than saying no, I want you to join me in saying yes, thank you, Sudhi, for a wonderful talk and for dealing with some very cute questions. So,
thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.